On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talked to Andre Weir about his book, The Martian. It started off free, then it became a New York Times bestseller, and now it's being made into a movie. We also have another great lineup of guests talking about the publishing industry, ebooks, how to market content, and much more. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by NatureBox. Order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like coconut date energy bites. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Welcome to Marketing Mavericks. We're at the intersection of everything technology and marketing. And today we're going to talk all about the world of publishing and what that means to get a book published, what it means for authors, what it means for publicists and readers. Are we still reading regular books? Or are we only downloading them? And where do we get our books? We're going to talk all about that. And I'm your host, Tanya Hall. So we've got quite the lineup. Our first guest is an author himself, and he went about an interesting way of getting his book published. And we're going to tell his story now. Andy Weir, the author of The Martian. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What a cool book, too, The Martian. I mean, just the name is... Just the name is intriguing. So, Andy, what is The Martian?
It's a story of a manned mission to Mars, and something goes wrong, and they end up stranding an astronaut there, and everybody thinks he's dead. So he's got to try to survive with the materials he has on hand, and people back at NASA don't even know he's alive.
It is a really interesting book. I highly recommend, if people haven't read it, to certainly read it. And it's very factual. So it's basically the main character, like you said, his story of being stuck by himself. And it's kind of his journal, really, his how he's surviving. And what made you decide to write this book? Why The Martian?
Well, I've always been a space nerd, like, my whole life. And I was actually just sitting around thinking of, like, oh, how would you do a manned Mars mission? And I came up with, like, well, basically, I mean, Robert Zubrin already came up with it. It's called Mars Direct. But the idea of how you could do a manned Mars mission. And I got to thinking, well, what about things that went wrong? What if this went wrong? How would you work that into the plan? What if this went wrong? And so on. And I started to realize those things that could go wrong and the solutions that you could do to fix them were pretty interesting. So I made a main character to suffer through all of that.
And like I said, it's really factual. I mean, you start off the book, it's very graphic. I mean, some of the language isn't necessarily...
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of profanity in the book.
Family
he's not
friendly.
Happy about being stranded on Mars.
No, he's not, you know. But as far as some of the science involved and some of the you know, terms and the ways that you came about. I mean, was this something that you had to do a lot of research for? Is this something as an engineer that you just knew? How did you prepare for this book?
I did tons and tons of research. Also, spaceflight and space travel and stuff is my hobby. That's a thing I'm into. I don't know. I like it. So I knew a bit going in, but I had to do quite a lot of research right from the get-go. I did a lot of research, a lot of math. Everything that's in the book is technology that actually exists or is very close to existing. Like, it's existing technology, but it has improvements, that sort of thing. And all the science and math, all the claims he made, like, oh, I can turn this much hydrazine into this much hydrogen and stuff like that. That's all accurate.
And the character, I've heard you say, is loosely based on you. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's... He's based on all my best qualities, I guess, and none of my bad ones.
Well, I think that's going to be up to the interpretation of the reader. Now, you're an engineer, so you mentioned this actually in the pre-show. We were talking about careers, but you've been a software engineer for how long?
25 years.
So this was a you know, something that I think people, a lot of times people think, well, I want to be a writer, I want to write a book, and this is just a dream. When did you finally decide, I'm going to actually do this? What pulled the trigger for you?
I never had to take a risk. And that's something I would tell anybody who's watching this show, is you can take your stab at being a writer without taking a big leap of faith. You can just, I mean, it's still an awful lot of work to write a book, especially when you're maintaining a job. But once you write a book, you can self-publish and you can be successful without any third party needing to take a risk on you. And you don't need to quit your job to do it. So in a roundabout answer to your question was, I decided to take the plunge into being a full-time writer once The Martian was already successful and earning me more money than my day job. So,
and you just, awesome. You just announced that you already started on book two, but I want to start talking about how not only did you decide to take a big chance and write the book, but you went about getting it published in an interesting way. You had a very difficult time actually with that. Talk about what happened once you were finished with the book. What was the next step?
Well, The Martian was actually just a dream come true in terms of how it ended up getting to print. But my writing career in general, I mean, I've wanted to be a writer my whole life. I just also like eating regularly and having a roof over my head. So I stayed in software engineering. I came into some money back in my mid-20s. I'm in my 40s now. And it was enough for me to last a couple of years. And I spent a few years trying to break into the writing world, and I couldn't. So I went back to engineering. Now, The Martian I wrote as a serial to my website. That was, I wasn't expecting to write this as a book and make it a profession. I was just writing it as a story that I thought, yeah, I'll post this and people might like it. And they did. Did you want me to tell you the whole?
Well, I want to talk about how you actually went from having a book that you couldn't get published to offering it for free, and what your experience was with Amazon, and how now you've actually, it's a New York Times bestseller. And it looks like it's been purchased. I think the screen rights have been purchased, right, by 20th Century Fox?
Yeah, that's going well, too. The strange thing is, there really wasn't ever any problem getting The Martian to print. They actually came to me. So I never made an attempt to make it into a print book. Everything went backwards from the normal, like, publishing story. So basically what happened was, I posted it in chapters to my website as a serial, and then I finished. And I thought, like, okay, that's done. Now I'll move on to something else. And some people were like, hey, I like your story, but I hate reading it in a web browser. Can you make it into an EPUB or something that I can put on my e-reader? And I'm like, okay, sure. So I figured out how to do that, and I put that all together. And then other people came back and said, like, hey, I'm glad there's an EPUB, but I don't have a lot of technical savvy and I don't really know how to download an EPUB from the internet and get it on my reader. Can you put it on Kindle? And so I said, sure, I'll figure out how to do that. I put it on Kindle. Kindle is like, it's not a publisher. Nobody has to approve your work. You can just put it up there. Anybody can put whatever you want up there. And so I posted it to Kindle, and I set the price at 99 cents, which is the lowest price that Amazon will allow you to set it to, because they're not a charity. They want to make money. And then more people bought it from Kindle than downloaded it for free from my site, which kind of shows you Amazon's reach into the kind of readership market. So it started selling really well, and then it made it into the top sellers list, and that made it start selling really well. It's a snowball effect. And then Random House took an interest. And so an editor at Random House was like, oh, I think I might want to offer this guy a publishing contract, but he should have an agent first. And so Julian Pavia, who's the editor at Random House, told his colleague, David Fugate, hey, you're an agent. You might want to be an agent for this guy because I'm about to offer him a print deal. And so all these people came knocking at my door just with emails. Hey, you want an agent? I'm like, sure. Oh, hey, you want a book deal? Sure. And then they're like, hey, you want to sell the movie rights to Fox? Sure. So I really had just a very easy time of it. And I mean, I almost feel guilty.
Well, no, I mean, that's what you want to happen. It's a great book, actually. Yeah, so you worked hard on it.
I wanted to be a writer, and then just everything fell into place. It was awesome.
So, okay, your main character, Mark, who's this is again, I have to say, based on you, right? He actually did something quite interesting. Explain how he actually creates water.
Okay. Well, so he's on Mars, and Mars has an atmosphere of carbon dioxide. And for various reasons, he has a thing that can collect the atmosphere and put it into pressurized containers. And I won't bore you with the details on that, but he has that. So he can get as much carbon dioxide as he wants. He also has a device in his HAB, which is the kind of the habitat, as it's called, the place where the astronauts lived during their mission, that can turn carbon dioxide back into oxygen. It just pulls the carbon off. It adds energy, pulls the carbons off, releases the oxygen. And that's called the oxygenator. So he realizes he can have as much oxygen as he wants just by harvesting carbon dioxide from Mars's atmosphere and then running it through the oxygenator to get the oxygen. Now, the craft that they landed on Mars in, which is a different craft than his crew left Mars from, was powered by hydrazine, which is a fuel that has a whole bunch of hydrogen in it. And so he went through this, he figured out the chemistry, or he already knew, and figured out how to liberate the hydrogen from the hydrazine fuel. Now, he has hydrogen and oxygen, and you put those together, and you have water. Unfortunately, when you put those together, they burn and explode, and he had some problems with that.
So, as this being made into a movie, there are obviously going to be some casting of different, you know, players. Who plays Mark? Who do you want to play you?
well, they've got Matt Damon set up to play Mark right now.
Oh wow!
Yep. Well, that's what they're saying. I'm an outsider on this, so the only things I know are things that you could find just by Googling around. But currently, the plan seems to be Matt Damon as Mark Watney and Ridley Scott to direct.
Well, that's what the chat room was saying. So I didn't know that. Wow. So
fingers crossed that they greenlight it.
So this next book that you're working on, is it going to be like a part two? Is it going to be also science? Like what? Come on, you can tell us. Nobody's listening.
No, sure. Yeah. It's called Zhek, Z-H-E-K, and it's a completely different story. It's a less rigidly scientific sci-fi. It's more of a traditional sci-fi story. And there are about like 7 chapters of it posted to my website right now that, you know, it's the same thing. It was a serial that I was working on, and now it's hopefully going
to
be a book.
So I'm going to go back to your website, and since the book was basically, you know, based on the information that was on your website, what drew so much attention to your website? How did you get people interested in your content?
Well, there was a few things. First off, so I've been doing various kind of creative stuff online for about 10 years. It started with a comic strip I wrote a very long time ago called Casey and Andy. And that ran for, I made 666 strips of that, actually. And then I made another webcomic called Cheshire Crossing. And then I just started writing short stories online. And one of them was called The Egg. And it was really, really popular. And so people shared that around with each other and posted links to it. And that got me a lot of regular viewers, readers, I guess. Sorry. And I would say The Egg was one of the main things. Yeah, I see you're putting it up on the screen there. That's The Egg. The whole story is about 1,000 words long. And you can see just above the title bar, you can see all the languages. People have sent me translations. Just here, I translated The Egg into Bokmål Norwegian for you. And so I'm like, all right, thanks, and post it to the site.
That's helpful. Okay, so you had a really popular website that you went to. You had no problem getting it published, but you offered it for free, right? So why did you offer the book for free?
Well, it was, I never realized that this would become my profession. At the time, I was just writing. It's my hobby. It's fun, and I like to write things, and everybody who writes things wants to have them read. And so it was just like anybody else who writes stuff and posts it online and wants people to read it. So I posted it up on my website. Like, here, I hope you like it.
What would your advice be to somebody who has a passion, they aren't creating content right now, maybe they don't have a website, but they're interested in doing that? I mean, so first off, what would your advice be from the standpoint of just getting a website or starting their content creation?
Well, so content creation is a pretty big, pretty broad category, but in general, my advice to writers is write. It's very easy to sit around and think about how awesome your story is going to be all day without actually writing it. The hard part is actually sitting down and writing it. So a story is not a story until you actually write it down. Until then, it's just sort of a daydream that you've been telling your friends. So step one is actually create the content. Then post it. It doesn't cost that much to have a website and just post it. Well, if it's good, if people like it, they'll pass it. They'll send each other the link. They'll pass it around, and you'll kind of get a word of mouth following, and it'll grow. It took me 10 years to build up my initial reader base. It wasn't some magic wand. It took a long time.
And how did you drive people? Did they just find your website? I mean, did you use some sort of analytics to get them there, or did you have people share your information?
I didn't put any effort into kind of marketing my stuff at all. Mostly, I just wanted a creative outlet. The website was a good place, and then people started telling each other about it.
If you had it to do over again, would you still give your book away for free, or do you think that was a part of its success?
It was definitely a part of its success. Giving away for free and having it on the website made it so that everyone could get at it really easily. And the barrier to entry was much lower. You didn't need to commit to buying a $20 hardback book. It cost nothing to spend a few moments reading it on a website. And then later on, when I posted it to Amazon or to Kindle, it was 99 cents. And once again, that's a really low barrier to entry. You're like, well, okay, I'll pay a buck. And especially if a friend of yours says, like, hey, I like this book, you might like it. And you go look it up on Kindle and it's like 99 cents. You're like, well, okay, I'm only risking a buck.
Well, yeah. But you have to charge something on Amazon. And I thought it was kind of interesting that you said, I read that you were talking about the numbers of people that actually bought it on Amazon rather than getting it for free, which I thought was crazy.
Yeah, it's just, I think that's just an indicator of how much power Amazon has into the market, that how well they can advertise and sell products, that they can outsell a product that is quote unquote selling somewhere else for free.
I would agree. I think it's definitely a telling story.
Okay, they're very good at this.
Yeah. Well, and if you could do one thing different, if you could go back and from the time that you started your website to the time that you or to today, you know, with having the movie rights purchased, what would you do different?
You know, honestly, everything went great. And I really don't understand, you know, all the things I did right or what I did right. I wouldn't poke at anything because, like, the outcome I got is exactly what I would always dream of. So I'm like, don't change anything.
And now we know how to create water. So.
Yes, now you do. You have the recipe.
We do. I think it's a great book. I'm really excited to see the movie. And I'm excited to see your next piece of work.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming on the show today.
All right. Well, thank you.
If somebody wants to connect with you, follow your website, or buy your book for free, how can they do that?
Well, it's no longer available for free.
Uh-oh.
Once I sold the rights, it's not mine to give away anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. So if you want the book now, you have to buy it.
If they want to do that, or if they want to follow you, how should they do that?
Well, they can go to my website, and I could tell you the URL. It's galactinet.com, but everybody misspells that. The best way is just to search for Andy Weir online, and you'll find the site.
Well, and I'll be tweeting it out, even though you're not on Twitter.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm a Luddite.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to having you back someday.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That is a great book, and if you haven't read it, you should. It is really interesting, and there's a lot of technical science and facts that he did put in the book that made it interesting, and so it's going to be a movie. Read the book first, though, right? So next up, we have our returning friend and co-host, Brian Rich, who is the managing director of Little M Media. Welcome, Brian.
Hello there. Happy National Mac and Cheese Day.
Is that today? You're wearing the appropriate color for Mac and Cheese Day.
That was exactly what I did. I coordinated my outfit with macaroni and cheese. Thank you for noticing.
You're quite welcome. So we've got an interesting lineup here. We're going to talk to, we're going to talk all about, you know, he mentioned before our guest did about Andy, about Amazon and the power of Amazon. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about a few other topics. But before we do that, we have a great, interesting guest with us who is the president of Gotham Ghostwriters, Dan Gerstein. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian.
Hey there. How are you?
Good.
And you no longer look sketchy. You fixed your lighting. That looks really good.
Oh, I'll always look sketchy. It's just, you know.
You can't be doing, sketchy.
Doing this from home, so no whiz bang studio to get the proper effect. But, you know, I'm a believer in the power of the written word, so, and the spoken word, so I'll have to settle for that.
As is your business. So you've
yes.
got... So, you know, I think Brian and I've got some questions for you, certainly. So I'd like to start with just this idea that what is Gotham Ghostwriters?
Gotham Ghostwriters is a full service ghostwriting firm. And unlike a lot of other agencies in the communications field that are made up of full time staff, I decided to try and provide a solution by creating a little bit of a different model and moving in the direction the internet was taking everything towards customization and specialization. So rather than hiring a lot of full-time staff, I built a network of editorial specialists, and we're in a position to connect and custom match talent with need and find writers and editors who are particularly well-suited for any given writing or editing project. But these days, the bulk of the demand and the bulk of the projects we're working on are ghostwriting books, writing book proposals, writing full manuscripts, and doctoring books that authors have developed on their own.
There was a time, I remember even, I think, as far back as 2011, when I was speaking at a conference, the 140 conference that Jeff Pulver puts on. He's got a variety of different people that speak, and I was getting ready to go on stage, and the girl before me was a ghostwriter, and I remember she was not well received. Like, that was a really controversial concept of being a ghostwriter, especially, you know, the people that, you know, they feel like the author is writing. But now I think it's more acceptable. I mean, I think people have, we've come a long way since even 2011. What changed? Why were we so skeptical of it then, and why would we not be skeptical of it now?
Well, given that this is an online show, I'm going to use an online meme to explain it, because the internet. The internet has completely exposed everything. The best example I can give that's relevant to this discussion is the President Obama's first speechwriter. It was a young guy named Jon Favreau, became a celebrity, right? 20 years ago, no one even knew who that the president had a full-time speechwriter, let alone their name. And now you have in the era of social media, information on demand, a gazillion channels that everyone can push information out there. The Wire show, that's the thing, that's the only way I can explain it, is this myth that CEOs, Jack Welch, or presidents, or these sage public figures are somehow writing 500-page books on their own has been completely shattered. And the reality is people don't care. They've grown accustomed to this idea. They know that the president has policy advisors. They know he has a press secretary who speaks for him, and they know he has a speechwriter. The only people who sort of hold on to this stigma, I find, are writers themselves, particularly writers of a certain generation who believe that somehow this was beneath them to help write for other people. You know, you talk to anyone under 40, they're like, yeah, of course the CEO has someone writing speeches or writing books for him. It's just, you know, accepted. It's a non-issue. And I think what's happened is we've actually gone back to the future in a certain respect, that collaborative writing, collaborative producing of content and storytelling has been happening since the days of Homer. And it's just a recent anomaly where we've had this kind of fiction of the auteur. There's a single voice that's creating and writing these great texts. But now with the internet, and it's not just that attitudes have changed. I think the technology has created this amazing opportunity for collaboration. And I think you're going to see more and more of it, where authors and writers will put their texts online before they publish it, to crowdsource criticism, to help them almost focus group what they're writing and get editorial input and notes before they release the full final text. And that's one of the many ways that technology, I think, is driving change in publishing and writing that's for the good.
Dan, Andy, who was on before, wrote a fiction book, or sort of a semi-accurate, you know, well-informed fiction book. And the stuff that your network of ghostwriters does largely, if not entirely, focuses on nonfiction. Is there a standard for what makes for a good book? You know, if someone comes to you and says, I need an author, obviously one who reflects my voice and things like that, you know, do your ghostwriters know how to write a book that's going to sell well, or a book that's going to be well received by critics? And is there sort of a science that you apply in that, you know, creation of the ghost written book that, you know, that others can follow?
The short answer is yes. I think the top ghostwriters and collaborative writers in this field have a sense of not only what sells, but to borrow a term of art and the communications and marketing field, what sticks, what's sticky. Increasingly, we've seen, and this is, again, all for the good, a movement away from telling and, you know, through advertising, paid media, and to showing, to adding value through your content as a way to sell people on you as a thought leader, or the service that your company provides, or the technology that your startup has created. And if I had to go back to one thing that I think distinguishes really good books on the nonfiction side, and where we specialize in writing thought leadership books, business books, to advocacy books, is, you know, what are you doing for the reader? How are you informing them? How are you enlightening them? What are you adding and helping them do better in their lives? And I think if you can answer that question at the beginning, then you're on the road to a successful book, in the sense of it achieving the author's larger goals.
And
go ahead, Ryan.
Well, I was going to say, just sort of as a follow-up from that, you know, we now live in a world which is heavily influenced by the actual marketing efforts. Can you get away with writing a mediocre book and marketing it really well and having it succeed? And sort of on the flip side, can you write a terrific book and not market it well, you know, and sort of have it underwhelm in terms of what the expectations might be? Or does the content and the quality of the book still, you know, drive the you know, the determination of whether or not it's going to thrive in the market?
I would say the short answer is it depends, both in terms of the genre of the book you're creating and how you define success. But yes, I think there are definitely books that are mediocre that catch a wave, or, you know, find their moment. You know, among writers, one of the great in jokes is about 50 Shades of Grey, is that here's a book that has become a worldwide phenomenon, and most writers will tell you it's really poorly written, and it's a mediocre story, but because it created this sensation and there was this buzz around it, and then the publisher who bought it, and as I recall, and Brian, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it started off as a self-published book. And that after it started getting an audience somewhat like Andy's book did, then I believe it was Random House stepped in and bought the rights to it and distributed it worldwide. And I think there's a great example of a publisher who, you know, caught a wave of interest and leveraged it to the hilt to really turn what is a mediocre text into, you know, one of the biggest sellers in the last decade.
I just want to state for the record, I've never read 50 Shades. I don't know. I just want to put that out there because I think it's important to my street cred.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
But you're absolutely right. There are plenty of really good books that never see the light of day or find an audience because the people who write them are either not adept at marketing or frankly don't care about it. And in that sense, you know, Andy's story, which is fantastic and I loved it, is sadly just not that representative. You know, that is a one in a million shot where someone who didn't who start off with no established network or credibility as an author, did nothing to market it, got discovered. It will be interesting to see, you know, if there is something like YouTube for writers that, you know, creates that level of discoverability for people where they don't actually have to push their name and their brand and get attention through other means. They can just put the content up there find and have people find it.
Finish your thought. I was just gonna say that I feel like there's more content now. But he said he started with a website, right? That was interesting, and he started building fans. He didn't say it happened overnight. He said it took him a while to start acquiring fans and build up that traction. So I think, you know, what possibly could be different with marketing or public relations is just a faster ramp up. But I think if you've got great content, eventually people will find it. I mean, what do you say to that?
I did mean to suggest it happened overnight, but just in listening to your interview with him, he made clear that he did not do a lot of marketing himself. It built up over time because people discovered him. And that's very, very unusual. But the flip side is, you know, one of the first things that self-published authors learn is that the only way really to find an audience quickly is to leverage your networks and leverage your connections and you know, the uniqueness of your story to get it out there and get people talking about you and your book. Again, I think for people who are listening, Andy's story, while it's great, is not necessarily representative or a formula for success for particularly for a self-published author.
So, you made a point of also saying that this is fiction. I think, Brian, you pointed out that Andy's book is completely different than maybe some of the content that you guys create there at your agency. And I think this kind, you know, especially when you talk about politics, right? So, I would think it would be possible that you would have a client that would come to you who had different views or a different point of view that would differ from yours. So how do you approach that? I mean, are you able to write about something that you don't believe or that you don't feel is right? How do you do
that? That's a great question, and it's something that does come up and we get asked about. I'm in a little bit of a different position because I run the agency, and much of what we do is help connect clients with writers. We're somewhat of a matchmaking service. But after that, we also provide some supporting services and consulting and editorial feedback, things like that. But for the most part, the writers, once they're paired off with their clients, are the ones who have to confront some of those difficult ethical decisions. And it really does vary. There's a spectrum of attitudes about it shades of gray of the lines people draw about what they'll choose. For me personally, for the people, the authors that and clients that we'll work with, you know, my primary threshold test is this person, has a story to tell, and we can help them tell the story. We're not endorsing their views by working with them to help them tell their story. We're just helping them express their voice. I think it's very similar to, you know, to some extent, like a television network that's running advertisements. There are definite boundaries for, there's certain people they won't accept ads for the most part, they don't have to believe in the product that they're advertising on the network to sort of say, okay, they're looking for a platform to promote it, and we can give them that opportunity. And to a certain degree, that's what we do. There are certain clients I would personally choose not to work with, but that has been very few and far between. I'm a independent-minded Democrat myself when it comes to politics, but we've worked with Republicans. We've worked with conservatives and libertarians, and I will continue to do so as long as I believe that they're good, decent people, and they need help expressing their views and getting their voice out there.
Dan, I have a question sort of about the influence that the audience has on the book process. So I think we're going to talk later in the show about how technology is changing reading and sort of the differences between traditional books and ebooks and things like that. How much do you think of the book writing process today is tailored around what we anticipate to be the reading experience? So a lot of marketing now starts with who the audience is and the way that they're going to receive the book and, or excuse me, receive the messaging and say, okay, you know, this audience really likes video, so we're going to do video advertising. Or this audience, you know, doesn't have the attention span, so we have to do, you know, Twitter or Vine only, very short form marketing. How much of someone who's sitting down to write a book or people you would counsel in writing a book, would you say tailor it to meet the needs of a certain type of audience or tailor it to meet the ability to be pushed out across different platforms, say, you know, it should be something that'll sound really good as an audiobook or something that can easily be excerpted and put in, you know, to a couple different digital formats. How much of the technology and the platform shapes the book writing process now, would you say?
I think it really varies based on, I think, two key thresholds. One is genre. There are certain books that really lend themselves because there's a heavy visual component to it, to multimedia and to ebooks, where it's just sort of a given at the beginning of the process. You're going to be thinking about how do you blend in, different kinds of visuals, whether it's animation, video, charts or graphs, or some other kind of interactive component, like maybe even asking people to just take a poll and provide feedback directly into the text. But then I think it's generational. And I think there's a big divide between, say, authors under 40 and authors over 40. And I think authors over 40, they're writing a book. And the book is a discrete, distinct thing. It's a written text. And that's what they're creating. Whereas people under 40, I think, have a much more fluid definition of what a book is. And, you know, under 30, certainly, they're thinking of, first and foremost about sort of how does the book serve a larger storytelling objective? How do I leverage other forms of communications to make the book that much more sticky? And then I think to a certain degree, if it's an individual author who's writing a serious book, a thought leadership book, the kind of books that we specialize in working on, again, I think they're focused much more on creating a text, a written text. Whereas if you're dealing with a major brand that's putting out a book and that, has a lot of resources and is accustomed to, whether it's through social media or their own website, integrating different forms of content, we'll be thinking more innovatively about creating a multimedia text that will allow them to kind of slice and dice it and get use out of it in many different ways, rather than just a standalone thing that you will sell and talk about.
You spent 10 years on Capitol Hill, deep in politics, and now you're an entrepreneur who's running a really successful business, helping other people by writing for them. I would imagine that's quite different. I mean, you've been very outspoken about politics and points of view, and now you are really somebody else's voice, or at least you're leading the cause for that. Is this a short term? I mean, do you miss being on Capitol Hill?
I don't miss being on Capitol Hill or Washington at the moment because it's just so toxic. I got into politics and I was, it sounds naive to say this now, but I believed in ideas can change the world. And, again, I got very excited by President Clinton when he won an election back in 1992. And I quit my job as a newspaper reporter and moved down to D.C. without a job. But over time, it became increasingly clear that, that it was a blood sport and that rather than campaigning to govern, we were governing to campaign, and everything became, about not just winning elections, but destroying the other side. And that's just, I had no appetite for that. Now, it's funny though that what you brought up about the differences, on the surface between my two career phases, but to a large degree, they're very, very similar because most of the work I did was helping Senator Lieberman, who I worked for 10 years, get his message across, whether it was writing speeches or, you know, statements for press conferences or as his communications director. So the work is actually very similar. It's just doing it for a much wider range of people in a much wider range of fields outside of politics.
You mentioned, we talked for a second, and Brian and I were just chatting about this. So I said about writing content for someone that maybe you have a different point of view. So in politics, clearly there are lots of points of view. And there are a lot of people that are just going to disagree, especially once the book is written. How important are reviews? How important are the comments that people make about the book, specifically on Amazon, for the results of the success of the book?
You know, it's a very good question. And I think, you know, to some degree, that from what I can tell, there's not a lot of good data to answer that question. I think it's largely anecdotal or based on your personal experience. For the kind of authors that use our services, increasingly reviews, you know, reader comments, and most importantly, sales are a secondary consideration for them. There's this whole universe of authors in the nonfiction world who are writing, whether it's thought leadership books or advocacy books or even memoirs, or self-help books, are putting the book out there to create a platform for themselves. It's their, you know, my bumper sticker phrase is the book is the badge. It's their badge of credibility, of expertise, of integrity, of authenticity. And they're using the book as a marketing vehicle or as a platform builder that they can leverage for a larger objective. And in those cases, you know, again, they'd love to sell books. It's not that they don't want to sell books, but it's not their primary objective. And I think one of the things that's been fascinating for me as an outsider who's somewhat new to the publishing field and has kind of an outsider's perspective, it's been quite odd to see that the publishing industry really can't wrap its head around that new universe of authors. And that's why so many of them, even some really influential, notable public figures, are choosing to bypass traditional publishers and go to either self-publishing platforms or custom publishers, because the traditional publishing industry is just so used to this one paradigm and it's all about sales that they don't know how to deal with these authors.
I would say one thing. I mean, so I've written and published as hard copy 2 books, and I, you know, blog and publish PDFs and sort of variations on ebooks all the time. And I think there is a credibility difference when you have a hardcover or a paperback or hardcover and then paperback and translated into other editions, whatever it is. There is something very important in the credibility conversation, I think, still when you have an actual physical book. And so while e-publishing has expanded the market, the audience, expanded the audience as well, but expanded the number of people who can publish and the range of ways in which people can bring their books to market, I think there is still a credibility gap among the audience in terms of whether that book has been published. It will no doubt change, and, you know, with folks like Amazon pushing ebooks as their primary mode of publishing and having, you know, very notable and very successful authors you know, going straight to ebook instead of ever considering any type of physical print book, that will certainly change. But I do think it's not just the publishing companies that have trouble wrapping their head around it. I think it's the readers, whether or not they choose to read the book in hard copy or not, having the ability to see a book in a bookstore or receive a physical copy still elevates the credibility of that author that much more.
I think there's no question about that, Brian. You're absolutely right that there is a certain demographic that believes that if the book's not in print, if it's not in hardcover, and it doesn't have a major publisher's imprimatur on it, it's not legitimate. That demographic is going to thin over time. We're in this transitional moment, and it's again fascinating for me as a an outsider now turned somewhat insider to watch it, and to see how different facets of the publishing industry are dealing with that. But you know, the again, if you look at the under 40 and particularly the under 30 demographic of both creative types, content creators, as well as readers and consumers, they're increasingly platform agnostic, right? The packaging of the content or the delivery form of it, you know, again, whether you downloaded it through iTunes, a song through iTunes, or viewed it on YouTube, is the channel that it's delivered is much less important than the content itself. And I think we're going to see that more and more with books. And, you know, one of the things I'm hoping to see is that publishers kind of get that they're increasingly, and there's readers who like to be able to have the hardcover or the paperback as well as the ebook. I'm stunned by the fact that the publishing industry still treats these things as two separate things, right? You can buy one or you can buy the other. What I think increasingly what readers want is the ability to consume the content on the platform that's most convenient to them at that moment. And they want to buy the content. And it would be really nice if you can sort of say, I'm going to buy a paperback, and I get the ebook for $2 extra. I think that would dramatically expand the readership particularly for an up and coming author that will pay dividends down the line. But I think sadly, traditional publishers are kind of blinded by this vestigial notion that you have to keep these things separate.
Okay, I think this is a really interesting line of conversation, and I want to talk more about it. But before we do, I want to thank our sponsor of today's Marketing Mavericks, which is NatureBox. So I'm going to say something that's going to surprise you. You should be snacking more. That's right. Yes, you should be snacking more. Why? Well, I've discovered NatureBox. That's right. NatureBox snacks have zero trans fats, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. NatureBox sends great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. Here's how it works. Click on the continue button to choose between three subscription options, then place your order. Once you are a member, you can select which snacks you'd like in your monthly box. You can select by dietary needs, whether you're vegan, soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, non-GMO. You can also select by taste, which is my preference, savory, sweet, and spicy. The next time you get a little cranky and you're hungry and you're ready to eat something, well, remember NatureBox. Snack guilt-free with coconut date energy bites, Santa Fe corn sticks, pear praline crunch, and over 100 more healthy choices. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of Marketing Mavericks. So thank you very much. And I have me some NatureBox for right after the show. I can't eat it right now because it's inappropriate, but it is really good stuff. I actually have two bags of this on my desk back in the production area where the producers sit. So it's really good. And you really should snack. It keeps your metabolism going. Are you a big snacker, Brian?
No, I'm not a huge eater, but thanks for sharing. way to just dangle that in front of you. I should find something that you don't have and be like, I have this really awesome thing, but I'm not going to give any to you because I'm on the other coast.
Appreciate that. These are sweet blueberry almonds. Doesn't that sound good? Saying.
Yeah, where Dan and I are, it's past dinner time. We stayed up and probably passed up eating so that we could be on the show on time. So just keep pressing the snacks there. I thank NatureBox as well for the opportunity to be on the show, but can we not stress how enjoyable they are while we're fasting in honor of good streaming conversation?
Dan, the conversation was happening in the chat room too, that they think you have a bottle of scotch behind you or something. I don't see it now. You've moved. You've got a different angle.
I have. Yes. My computer was about to die, so I had to plug in.
Oh, no. That's...
Yes.
does make for a bad interview. Well, I want to invite our other guest on to talk about some of these things, who has a point of view as well. He's actually been on the show before, and a super great guy. We love having him on. His name is Jeffrey Cullen. He is a social media influencer at Microsoft. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hey, how are you?
I am good. I am good. I am good. You're at Microsoft right now, staying on for us as well.
Yeah, but it's a lot earlier than those on the right coast. We're coming up, I guess, you know, a little bit, almost to 6 o'clock. Right coast, almost 9 o'clock. So
the right coast.
almost snack time, presumably.
Well, I should say the right coast.
You want to start cooking? Go right ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to have some Nature Box while you guys just continue to talk about that. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So you know, Jeff, you've been, I think, you know, having this conversation about the idea of publishing and how that's changed, and writing and content. You create your own content. You've been doing that for some time. In fact, you used to have, do you still have a podcast? Or you used to have one?
Yeah, I still have a podcast. Still write weekly. I liked what Dan was saying. I think there's a lot of people out there that I think have a hard time understanding how the changing dynamics of how we produce content has really changed, you know, what the idea of publishing really is. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different things I think that what an individual can do in terms of creating content that isn't necessarily writing anymore, that still sort of falls into the publishing realm, just because it's interactive. I think, you know, a lot of people who do write books per se or write thought leadership, they're probably also creating or producing other forms of content. They might be doing snippets, audio snippets, video snippets, lots of different ways to sort of get their thinking out there in ways that the customer or the consumer or others want to, the best way for them to sort of consume that content.
Jeff, one of the things Tanya and I were talking about before the show was how reading is changing. And there was actually this fascinating story, I guess it was last week now or a few days ago, about how thanks to the trackability that e-readers have, we're finding more and more about how much audiences are actually reading e-books. And it's sort of destroying part of this myth that is tied to publishing and to books and to a number of forms of content where you say, you know, I've read this, but, you know, maybe you only read 2/3 of it, or you jumped around, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you're at Microsoft, it's a technology company. You guys obviously think a lot about sort of the trackability and how that user experience is going to be shaped and monitored and things like that. What do you look at when you think about the reading experience and how it's changing, or the content consumption experience and how it's changing, and, you know, how much that should influence the way we think about what you were just talking about, sort of the varying definitions of publishing and the ways that books and whatnot might come to life going forward?
Yeah, you know, Brian, it's a great question. It's a really good thing to actually look at. I mean, I think one of the things that you have to look at now is, you know, we think about Tesla, the car, Elon Musk. When the New York Times journalists had said, hey, you know, this car has issues, and Elon Musk was like, actually, I have all the data that shows that you didn't drive it the right way, et cetera. I think now we're seeing that with all forms of media now, streaming media. Hey, I watched this whole series on Netflix. Well, did you? Netflix has that data to show which pieces of content people watched or what they didn't. Amazon as well. Music. Spotify knows what tracks are streaming, people are streaming the most of. Google knows what people are actually streaming on YouTube, because so many of younger generations actually listen to music directly on YouTube. So there's a lot of factors now that data can actually be used to figure out more and more what people enjoy, what people like, what types of content they're actually wanting to immerse themselves in. I think one of the big areas that has to change in the overall industry is, we've measured it for so long, is, my blog or my website gets so many visitors. So what? I mean, so many visitors can come there and so many can bounce off of it. I think what you have to actually look at now is time on a site or time spent with a piece of content, because there's a lot of books I've read, and I'm a huge fan of obviously Malcolm Gladwell and a lot of his books and the Freakonomics series. I have read probably and reread many chapters within those books. And electronically, they know what chapters I've read and reread because I've read those on my, you know, e-reader or whatnot. They would not necessarily know that based off of a print edition. All they know is that, hey, we sold X amount of print editions. I think what's happening with publishing is a lot's what's happened with an industry I worked with in for many, many years from 1996 to 2002, and that's the music industry. There's a lot of traditional holdouts that sort of, and Dan brought this up, and it was a great point. I'm glad he made it. A lot of traditional holdouts that think, well, you know, you buy a book, and that's one form, and then you can buy an electronic version, and that's another form. The music industry doesn't look at it that way anymore. I mean, if you buy a CD, or you buy a digital download, or you buy a song, it registers whatever that piece of content is. And I think the publishing industry has to just look at things in a platform agnostic manner, as Dan noted, in terms of if you're purchasing a piece of content or downloading a piece of content, it's the content that's the most important part. And obviously authors would agree with that as well, because they want people to actually read what they write. They're not necessarily interested in the form that it's delivered in. And I think more and more as we move into a world where the shape and the form of technology is going to move at a more rapid pace, you know, you have to look at the content that people actually are consuming rather than the form that it's actually packaged in.
So then if I was going to be a client of Dan's, would you advise me to go and ask for help writing just a chapter, for example, and to develop a book similar to the way Andy was talking about at the beginning of the show, you know, serially, right? Instead of spending what is, you know, a significant amount of time to write a book and then, you know, go through the editing process and things like that. Given the way people are consuming content and the flexibility that they want, would you suggest that book authors, you know, now start to think more piecemeal about how they put these things together and you know, embrace that new range of definitions for publishing?
Yeah, I mean, think about, again, the music industry. You know, a band used to, or an artist used to sit down and write an entire album. Why they do that anymore is beyond me, because of the delivery system. If it were up to me, if I was an artist, I'd be delivering a new song every week. There is no need for, you know, a long form album necessarily anymore, because you can get new content on a weekly basis. New authors actually should be thinking of, how do I write maybe a few paragraphs of each chapter a week that I deliver to my audience? Because then that actually keeps people interested in the content that's being delivered, and you're not waiting 3 years in between works. Now, of course, this might be a little bit more difficult for fiction writers, and I understand, you know, what they go through, because they might say, there's no way, Jeff, I'm going to want to do that, because I might, you know, I have to sort of sit with the editing process. But I think those who sort of more, you know, follow more of the stream of consciousness, sort of the Hunter S. Thompson or the Jack Kerouac school of thinking, could do that, because it's just a matter of, hey, I'm going to write and I'm going to deliver. And I think audiences actually want more of that. They really want to feel the emotion that writers have when it comes to, you know, what are they thinking? How are they feeling? How are they expressing themselves? I even think on the nonfiction thought leadership side, I realize that a lot goes into the research side. But I think the speed of research, if you can pick that up, it's I think more and more we're actually going to see some authors delivering, you know, basically chapter by chapter, and then packaging that up and saying, okay, here's the full book. But if you've read it already, great. If not, here it is in one package, and you can read it all together. I'd love to see some publishers actually say, instead of waiting to download a full book for, let's say, you know, for $4 or $5 or $10, you know, you could buy you could buy a chapter of a book each week that the author puts it out for 99 cents. That actually adds up to maybe the cost of the book. It's also another revenue stream for them. I think, again, you have to think about the different ways that you can create revenue in a way that's that hasn't existed in the past, or that's, you know, that's different. The music industry, I think, for a while had, you know, was very averse to that. They only wanted you to buy full albums because they made a lot of money off of that. And they realize now that they have to deliver things based in a single format. And now they realize they can't even do that. They have to deliver via streaming services because that's the majority of where most people are going in terms of how they consume music. And I think publishers have to look at, again, at a lot of these models in terms of, you know, how do they get out in front of where consumers already are. So actually, if I was using Dan's services, I think in a lot of respects, I may go to him and just say, hey, I have the theme of what I want to do. Can you help me sort of plan that out or map that out? And then we can, you know, either I can hire a ghostwriter to do that, or they could at least write the main sort of chapter. Because again, artists, music artists don't necessarily write the hit single right away. That might not come till later. But if they at least have the theme of the album, they know what they're working on and they can deliver song per song. I think authors have to, you know, sort of take a page from that book.
So, and Jeffrey, you make some really interesting points about how technology itself is lending to different ways to get the content out. Not that the content is changing as much as it is the technology and helping us get fans and breaking down the wall. So, Dan, Jeff mentioned something about, you know, the technology now tells us, right, what page we're on, what content we're looking at. So we have really specific information and potentially on demographics, on the type of person, where the person geographic, where they live. So there's all kinds of data that we can gather. So my question for you, Dan, are you guys using that, or how important is that, especially for political content, politicians that are really trying to gauge their audience, their constituents?
Well, I would say that to a large degree, authors are using that data much more effectively than traditional publishers. You know, I have a colleague, Michael Levin, who's a ghostwriter and runs a really neat firm out on the West Coast called Business Ghost, who I've seen him do this shtick where he talks about the kind of backwardness of the publishing field as a business and its business model in this environment. And he puts it this way. Publishing is the only business in America where, rather than going out and finding products that people want, publishers passively wait for agents to bring things to them that they may want to publish. And it's not based on data to a large degree. It's based on this romantic notion and people's tastes and these tastemakers. And I think in this day and age, that model is just unsustainable. And I think the authors that are succeeding increasingly are the ones who are following Jeff's advice and thinking about, okay, I have insight, I have expertise, I have stories to tell that will help people and that will create value for them, and then it create value for my own brand and reputation. How do I get the information out there? Well, sometimes you can put it on a website, you can put it through a series of blog posts. Sometimes you can package those blog posts into a book. And one of the great things about technology is that it has really changed the definition of what a book is. You used to, when you had a print book, when you were putting it on paper, you had to pass a litmus test. If it wasn't 150 pages, 200 pages, it didn't have that thickness, it didn't pass muster, the laugh test, as a book. Now with ebooks, there's no way to see how long the ebook is. And actually in that format, shorter is sometimes better. Right. And so what it's just led to is now the book itself is a very fluid, varied thing. And you can put up a Kindle single that's maybe, you know, 10, 20,000 words, call it a book. You can crank that out in 6 weeks, and it takes, you know, almost instantaneously to upload it and get it distributed. That creates all kinds of possibilities. So what I would advise our clients, and I do advise our clients, is to not necessarily think about there's only one way of doing things. Think about what your end objective is and then come up with a publishing strategy that's tied to achieving your objective. Sometimes that might mean creating a traditional 250-page book that will be released as a hardcover. But that's not the only way to do it anymore, and oftentimes it's not the best way.
For both of you, but Jeff, why don't we start with you? A few weeks ago on the show, we actually talked about Hillary Clinton's book and the way that she marketed the book, specifically starting with an audio excerpt of her sort of introductory letter that framed the reason why she wrote the book, and then very selective excerpts going out to her email list, which was the only way to get them, and things of that nature. Are there authors that you have seen who have kind of embraced the new way that books are either going to be written or pushed out that you think we would all kind of benefit from looking at? Are there, you know, beyond the Seth Godin's who, you know, has been sort of publishing books on his blog every day in little tiny chunks for a long, long time and was often held up as a standard. Are there other authors that you follow or that you've seen that you think from a marketing standpoint are really doing interesting things?
Yeah, you know, I think most of them fall within the nonfiction realm. Most of them are thought leaders. They're writing about, they're either in the self-help section or they're really writing about things that I think we all feel sort of passionate about, the changing media landscape, the acceleration of technology. Stephen Levitt, who writes, I think, you know, the Freakonomics series, I mean, that's really based on a podcast. So if you think about it, he didn't come up with the idea of doing a book. He had a podcast, and then he said, "How am I going to shape this into a book?" And then he's written two very interesting books. But he also still has a continuing podcast series that I think is very unique in terms of between books. There's still a lot of content that exists there, and you find that a lot with authors. Unfortunately, they write a book. Then they might go out and speak quite a bit about it, but there's no other content that actually exists beyond that. And I think the new relationship between authors and audiences, they sort of always have to be on. Joshua Klein, who wrote Reputation Economics, I got to meet with him late last year in 2013, and he had a blog and decided, you know, I like to write a lot for this blog, and I want to turn this into a book, and he turned it into a book. And much of what he asked in terms of that book, he basically used a lot of user feedback from the blog to figure out like how he wanted to map that book. That's hard to do if you don't have a lot of these other areas. If you're just sort of a writer and saying, I'm going to write, I think one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, if you're just going to write, you're not reaching a whole audience that actually exists out there, and you're not getting two-way feedback. And I think one of the things that people really do want is they want two-way feedback in this day and age in terms of figuring out what thought leadership they should write or what areas they should actually pay attention to. I actually think nonfiction writers, and Brian, maybe you can help me here, Dan, you can help me here. What was the name of that movie back in like the 90s where the author killed off like the character, and then the fan got really upset, so he
King one.
Was it Stephen King? She like was like, no, you're not gonna kill that character off. You're gonna bring
Misery.
Him back to life.
Misery.
Yeah.
Bates. I mean, that's a great example of what nonfiction writers should be doing. Not in the sense of, you know, letting fans dictate the story. I mean, again, they're authors. They want, you know, they want to have their original work. But I think it would, you know, in this day and age where you have two-way communication everywhere, it'd be awesome to see more authors saying, "Hey, you know, my fans really don't want me to kill this character off. I'm going to sort of figure out a new role for what that character might be." Because you get passion from fans, and then fans are like, "Oh my gosh, this book is getting amazing! I'm so glad the author went this direction." I think in the old day of way of doing things would be the author just saying, "I'm not going to listen to any of my fans," and then the fans, of course, say, "I'm never buying a book again from that author," and you run into a lot of contempt. So I think there's just a lot of ways to explore how we deliver, you know, communications in this day and age. I do think there is still a place for books that take the form of the written and video and audio form, so that when someone's reading something, they actually could then watch a video that actually goes and explains what the author is actually trying to write about rather than a graph or a graphic in a printed version, you actually have multimedia that exists. And we're going to see much, much more of this, I think. I mean, obviously, some of the bigger newspaper publishers have moved into this realm. The New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian do a lot of this. I think it's only a matter of time that we see this in actual book form in terms of authors saying, hey, you know, instead of me, you know, explaining this in a written form, I'm gonna actually create a visual piece of content of, you know, whether it's video or an infographic or something that actually lives within the book and that allows people to actually learn things a little bit in a better manner. I mean, I have two young daughters, and I think that the way they will learn about things through books will be so different from how I learned about them when I was in elementary school in the late 70s, early 80s.
You just totally dated yourself.
I did. I shouldn't do that, right?
Well, Dan, I know Brian wanted your opinion on that, too. What do you say about
that? Yeah, I think Jeff made a great point. And I think one of the things I'd like to see more of, and I'm optimistic that, again, the more innovative authors who understand the importance and the of connecting with their audience, the expectation of the audience to have access to the writers they read, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, like I said, one potential application of that is putting up early drafts of what you write for feedback from your audience, and then incorporating that feedback into whatever becomes the final version or the published version. But I also think something that would be really exciting and is the opportunity to crowdsource, particularly on nonfiction books, whether it's self-help, thought leadership, a range of different genres, where you're using stories and anecdotes and data to bring your story to life or prove a point or, you know, enhance an argument by putting your, you know, initial nuggets of your content and germs of ideas online and through social media and asking your audience to share their stories, share their experiences, and provide different perspectives will creates tremendous value for the author to quickly assimilate that information and be the conduit to a larger audience that will feel empowering to the people who've contributed to that and build a bond that is much, much greater than anything we've seen before.
Yeah, I got to agree with Dan. I think 2 years ago I tried. I mean, I still have my blog that I write quite a bit on, Futurist Lab, and one of the things that I was writing was a article or, you know, a post called Enthusiastically Inefficient, all about sort of the modern workplace. And I wrote about, you know, why I thought the modern workplace was inefficient, but then I opened it up to everybody else and said, you know, hashtag it with this and we'll crowdsource a bunch of information. And my target audience was HR representatives. I mean, obviously I wanted information from everyone, but I really wanted people who worked in sort of human resources and talent development to include their pieces. And I think it was a little ahead of the curve, but I think those are things that more authors need to do, because you now can reach out to, you know, millions of people across the globe to, as Dan said, you know, to crowdsource a lot of information and gain insight and figure out, you know, lots of different problem areas. I think one of the things that's interesting is we create a lot of applications and technology in the world that sort of entertains us, but I think we have the ability to really solve some of the world's biggest issues, and that could be in the form of crowdsourcing and instead of publishing that in the form of sort of a modern, you know, book, it would be something that's almost takes the shape of almost like a wiki in some respects. It's almost ever changing, and that's something I think that a lot of people can really get excited about, especially if you're sort of the lead author on running a lot of that data and information and research and compiling all of it and actually creating sort of this book that you're the writer of, but you're really using almost everyone else's voice and research to create that information.
So, Jeff, you have some really interesting points of view on all of this. And as marketers, I think you've got some really great ideas, whether it's music content that you're creating, you're writing a book. What are some of the books, though, that you would recommend, or maybe some people who have blogs or publish in the way of marketing that has been important to you? Like, who would you say that we should check out when it comes to learning how to create content and getting it out there? Who do you follow?
Ooh, wow. I mean, I've been a big fan of Seth Godin for a long time. You know, all marketers are liars is, I think, an essential book for all marketers to read, really sort of a good place to start. The Design of Business by Roger Martin. I make all of my team read that, how design thinking gives you an advantage. And the reason I actually turned to that book is because design thinking, a lot of that is really based on, you know, how do you communicate to people in a way that they'll you know, your communications will really stick. I think Dan used the term stickiness. I mean, that's always, you know, there's so much that's written and made on a daily basis in the world now. It's very hard, I think, for us to not be distracted. It's hard for us to actually retain information. So a lot of what that book really talks about is, how do you design things in a way that will allow people to retain information, whether you're trying to sell something to them or market something to them, or, you know, if it's actually at a higher level and you need people to actually learn something so that they can pass that information along. Again, big fan of all Malcolm Gladwell's books. You know, a book that I actually read recently that, you know, doesn't deal so much with content as just, you know, the fact that it deals with how things should operate is The Lean Startup. Read that in May. I know it's 2 years old, but I still think it's a really good book. And the reason why is because it really talks about how you build a product and then you listen to what your customers are saying, and then you sort of build into your product and enhance that, but you're communicating with them at all times. So we hear lots of terms like growth hacking, et cetera, but it really is, you know, how do you build something that you're building it with, you know, your intentions of, or pardon me, the customer's intentions in mind. And a lot of marketing materials, I think nowadays miss that mark. They don't really want the feedback of the customer. It's still sort of a one-way street. And I think marketers still have a long way to go in terms of how they market. I'm a big fan of the sort of rise again of evangelism. We're going to see quite a bit of this, which is, you know, evangelism has existed, you know, since Mesopotamia, and how people, basic ancient civilizations used to barter with each other. But we're going to see more and more of this rise again, because you can't be a brand and basically say to people, hey, here's why you should buy my solution. People are just like, I don't care about your solution. There's no thinking there. There's nothing that gets me excited about it. You're just trying to sell. And evangelism really takes sort of an anti-corporate viewpoint in some respects and shapes it in a way where it might say, here's the problems that exist in the world. Let's look at A, B, C, and D. How do we solve those issues? And then from that, what the user actually gains is, wait a minute, the person who wrote this didn't even mention their brand. They never even mentioned their solution, but they work for this company and they have this solution that might exist. I like where they're going with this, because they actually sort of have my business intention in mind. I'm going to pay more attention to what they have to say. And that's really where the essence of content marketing flows. It's not just one piece that someone says, oh, I'm going to sign up and, you know, use this company as a solution provider. It's multiple pieces, which is why modern storytelling in some respects is like writing a book. I think more and more marketers now, those who actually have journalism degrees, it's like the new MBA. I guess I hit the nail right on the head, because when I went to school in the 90s, I, you know, majored in journalism, and all my business friends sort of laughed at me and, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything with that. And I feel like journalism and publishing now is really almost where marketing is now. I find myself explaining to a lot of MBAs and CMOs how they actually have to set up their operation. So a lot of books that really explain sort of that new, this new area of how journalism and brand publishing really has an effect on marketing, I think is key. But I think a lot of the best sort of articles that aren't really necessarily in the form of books, most of them are still, I think, in the blogosphere, on how people can sort of stay, you know, up to date on the changing dynamics of communications.
Well, I am looking forward to your book, because you've written and you've been published, but I love your points of view on that. So Dan, what would you suggest, you as an entrepreneur, as somebody who decided to leave one career and go to another, and you created your own startup, or maybe advice for you know, people who are want to be authors or want to be content creators. What would you suggest they follow, blogs or books that they should check out?
Well, just to piggyback on Jeff's comment and to reiterate, it's we've gone from the tell era to the show era. And, you know, and this is one of the reasons why, to Jeff's point about, you know, journalism actually becoming a journalistic background becoming an asset is, you know, the first rule of writing is show, don't tell. And that's increasingly become not just for, you know, journalistic writing or, you know, serious book writing, but all forms of content creation. You know, show me that you're smart. Show me that you have something of value. Show me how your service or your technology is going to make my life better. I have access to all the information in the world at any time in real time through the internet. So give me a reason, a justification for spending time with your content. As in terms of a single book, you know, I would say the best primer out there for someone who's looking to kind of figure out publishing as a platform to do other things and achieve their goals would be Ape by Guy Kawasaki. I mean, here's a guy who's very smart, has his own brand, and has credibility telling this story and sharing information because he went through it himself. And he's now sharing his insights from personal experience to a much wider audience so that you don't have to make those mistakes. I mean, talk about something of value. So that's if you know, I had to recommend one book, it would be that book, Ape. It's called Author, Publisher, Entrepreneur.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us for the show, as well as you, Jeff, and my co-host, Brian. If somebody wants to follow you, Dan, how can they do that?
You can reach me via email at dan@gothamghostwriters.com or through Twitter at Dangerstein. I am one of the few Jewish superheroes out there.
I like that Twitter handle. And how about you, Thank Jeff? You. How can we follow you?
Through Twitter at DJ GEOFFE or through my blog, Tumblr. Oh, pardon me. Sorry. Futuristlab.tumblr.com.
And Brian, if somebody wants to follow you, how can they do that?
You can follow me on Twitter. My name, BRIANREICH. Or you can Google me. I'm fairly findable. I am not the former high school basketball star. I'm the other Brian Rich, BRIANREICH, just to be clear.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. You've all been swell guests and co-hosts. I appreciate it. You guys have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Bye, guys.
And that concludes this episode of Marketing Mavericks. I'm Tanya Hall. You can follow me on Twitter by going to @TanyaHallRadio. You can find me on Facebook. You can also like Mavericks on Google Plus. So if you're a Google Pluser, you should go to Mavericks and let me know what articles you like. You can even email. That's right. Pretty old school, but you can email us. You can go to mavericks@twit.tv. I want to hear from you. I want to hear what guests you like and what topics that you want us to discuss. Thanks, everybody. Until next week, that's a wrap.